The last investigator I met with was Dr. Brian Reaney from Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine. And to begin, we chatted about renal cell carcinoma and specifically how he approaches first and second line therapy in a patient with metastatic disease.
So outside a clinical trial, sunitinib and pazopanib are the standards of care. And it honestly has as much to do with kind of the timing of when the drugs were developed and the way the trials were run than that they're the best TKIs per se. But I think most people have accepted them as the standard of care. And sunitinib is the control arm of all the large phase threes that are going on now with the checkpoints. In the US, my understanding, it's fairly evenly split between them. We tend to be sunitinib users, mostly because being involved in the early trials and really a high level of confidence about how to dose adjust and schedule adjust, as we talked about, supportive care management. I tend to choose pazopanib for sort of the older, more comorbid patient. I know some other folks do that. It's probably not fair. It's not necessarily based on data. It's just sort of that sense of what people can tolerate. I think the field has sort of moved beyond that question now, again, with the emergence of checkpoints, which we'll talk about. I think that's the background. I don't think it's an interesting question anymore. I think either one is fine.
What about beyond first line? How do you decide about the next TKI? Maybe you're going to give a checkpoint inhibitor in between, but, and particularly, maybe you can talk a little bit about the data that's come out recently with cabozantinib and lenvatinib and how you utilize these agents, if at all, in your practice.
Sure. So I tend to use nivolumab second for most of my patients. It has obviously level one evidence of a survival benefit, and it is exceedingly well tolerated. Having given TKIs for a decade plus, and then now giving that agent, I'm really struck that patients who come in having gotten a previous TKI and now are on nivolumab almost uniformly tell me how great they feel. Probably not because of nivolumab per se, but just because they're off their previous therapy and they didn't realize how bad they felt, honestly. So because of the risk-benefit ratio, I think is very much in its favor. And unless there's a good reason not to, I would say probably 8 or 9 out of 10 patients in my practice will get nivolumab second. After nivolumab, we don't really know. There's not any prospective data. There are a couple of retrospective data sets on TKIs after nivolumab. Not surprisingly, they have activity. I don't think we know that one is better than the other in that setting. We're doing a trial of axitinib in that setting. I think any TKI would have activity. Axitinib is tended to be used after nivolumab, in part based on data from the AXIS trial and previous axitinib studies, suggesting that it had a great effect after cytokines, that after high-dose IL-2 and interferon, it seemed to have a particularly robust effect. And I don't know whether that has anything to do with the drug itself or just the fact that it's one of the only agents to be studied in that setting. So that's often our go-to drug after nivolumab. Cabozantinib, we've started to use a little more. In that setting, I tend to use it in later lines of therapy. Lenvatinib everolimus, I've not used. I'm a little skeptical of the efficacy data, and its toxicity is very substantial.
Can you talk a little bit more about the data that we do have available with cabozantinib and what you think it means?
Sure. So, cabo is a very active drug. There's a relatively small phase one in a very refractory setting that had a signal and then sort of launched into the phase three versus everolimus, the so-called Meteor study, which was published and presented about a year ago. And it showed really benefit across all endpoints, a response rate, PFS, and OS. And it was, I think the first TKI to show OS in that setting. Again, the Nivo data came out about the same time. It can be a very toxic drug.
Just to be clear, that was against everolimus, a second light there.
Was against everolimus, yeah. So it certainly wasn't against nivolumab, obviously. And it wasn't against a TKI. I think many of us would have liked to have seen a TKI control in that arm, but from regulatory and other purposes, everolimus was certainly a reasonable standard in that setting. And again, the data is robust in terms of response rate and tumor shrinkage and all the things that we're trying to do, of course, balanced against the toxicity. So again, it comes down to a benefit-risk equation.
What about in the first line? We saw the CABOSUN data comparing CABO to sunitinib at ESMO. Can you go through that and what you think that means?
Sure. So that was a small randomized phase two, about 70 patients per arm that looked at, as you said, cabozantinib versus sunitinib in intermediate and poor risk RCC. And the data presented showed a PFS advantage, basically, is what it showed, and a response rate advantage. To me, there were some issues with that study. I think probably it's been a little bit overinterpreted, in my opinion. Patients who got sunitinib on that arm did exceedingly poorly for reasons that I don't understand. The response rate was only 18%, which is lower than we've ever seen with sunitinib. The PFS was 5 months, which seems low compared to some other retrospective data sets. And so it points out the perils of the randomized phase two is that you want it to be a randomized phase three. You want it to be a definitive comparison, but there are many methodologic reasons why it's not. So I won't personally use cabozantinib in the frontline setting pending more data, but I know that, you know, having talked to other experts in the field, that there are people who will think about adopting it as a frontline agent. So we'll see. I think there are other plans for larger randomized studies now incorporating checkpoints. So that exact question won't be asked and answered again, but I think there'll be some more data forthcoming.
I'm curious too, in terms of your perception of tolerability of cabozantinib. I've heard mixed things. I remember hearing about this originally in prostate cancer. I know there's an issue of dose. You actually have a patient who got cabozantinib I'd like to hear about. But before you get to that, can you kind of just tell me your gestalt feeling, first of all, from the clinical research data, as well as from your clinical experience, about how cabo's tolerability compares quality-wise with the other TKIs and sort of how easy or difficult it is to use, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think, so we participated in the registration trial and have started to use it off study. So we have some experience, not extensive, but some. I think it is a tougher drug. And I think one of the issues is that it kind of gets back to that titration question. So in the Meteor study, 60% of patients had to go down in dose from the starting 60 milligrams. So it tells you that most patients aren't going to tolerate the initial dose. And I think half of those patients had to even go down to 20. So because of its long half-life and just the tablet size, it's not as titratable as some other drugs like axitinib. And I think that would be helpful for that drug to be able to be titrated a bit more, because we don't know what the right dose is for patients. And starting everybody at a toxic dose may not make sense either, obviously. These patients are third and fourth line, so they're a little bit beat up, unlike frontline patients. So their ability to withstand that initial toxic dose, I think, is probably a little bit less.
What are the major tolerability issues with cabo?
Similar to other TKIs, fatigue and diarrhea, I think, predominantly. Mucositis, LFTs, the other things that we commonly see, blood pressure. You know, I think probably fatigue and diarrhea are the biggest from a day-to-day patient standpoint.
So I was curious, again, before we get to your case, I was curious when I asked you if you had anybody you could present who got lenvatinib, everolimus, you said you haven't given it. So I'm curious maybe what your take is on the data and on that combination.
Yeah, so that's a tricky one. It's also, you know, just a randomized phase two with only 50 patients per arm. And I think what was surprising to me and maybe somewhat unbelievable is, you know, there had been other very large trials of VEGF plus mTOR. So there was two trials of bevacizumab plus either temsirolimus or everolimus, two large randomized phase threes that were both uniformly negative. There had been other attempts to combine VEGF and mTOR that were uniformly toxic. So there may be something special about lenvatinib that allows it to be combinable and allows it to be more efficacious, if you will, although I'm not aware of any biochemical properties. You know, the PFS in that trial was initially reported over 14 months, which is longer than any frontline data we have. So I worry that it suffers, again, from what we see in randomized phase twos is a small, perhaps unrepresentative data set, hidden biases and imbalances that just aren't accounted for. And again, the level of toxicity is exceedingly high. Cabozantinib, I think, can be more toxic. Lenvatinib, everolimus is an order of magnitude more toxic, at least from the data that I've seen, again, not having personally given it. So to me, I'm waiting for more data. I don't really feel comfortable in a non-curative setting giving people an exceedingly toxic regimen like that.
What do we know about lenvatinib as a single agent in RCC?
Well, not much, I guess, is the short answer. So there was a lenvatinib monotherapy arm in that lenevrolimus randomized phase two, and it performed how you would expect a VEGF agent to perform in terms of response rate and PFS and things like that. So it wasn't surprisingly good or bad in that setting. I'm not aware of other data. There may be some phase one data that preceded the phase two with lenvatinib single agent, but there's not a wealth of data.
It's pretty impressive data in thyroid.
Yeah.
Which I'm not sure exactly. Obviously, it's a different disease, but on the other hand, I'm not sure why it's so effective in thyroid. You mentioned the fact that your take on lenvatinib, everolimus, is a lot of toxicity. Do you think it's more the everolimus in quality or TKI in quality? And what do you see with everolimus?
I think my sense, my recollection is it's more TKI in terms of toxicity. I mean, everolimus by itself is fatigue, asthenia, some mucositis, a little bit of cytopenias, rash, anemia, you know, so reasonably well tolerated, you know, kind of like a TKI, although obviously mechanistically different. And the combination is, again, TKI-like fatigue and diarrhea, I think, were the predominant ones. I don't remember the exact percentages, but I believe the incidence of grade 3 toxicity was over 70%, might have even been close to 80%.
With the new TKIs, and particularly with nivolumab now coming on board, where does everolimus fit in your cascaded treatment?
Yeah, I think it's really being moved out of the algorithm, honestly. I was never a big everolimus fan. I didn't really find it quite active. I didn't really have any patients who were long-term responders to that drug. Unlike the TKIs, where we have a clinic full of patients who have 2, 3, 4, 5-year responses, obviously those are exceptions. But over time, you get a sense of that there are a significant subset. With the TOR inhibitors, I don't think that's true. There's some data about patients with TOR and TSC mutations who can have long responses, but that's almost anecdotal. So I think with the nivolumab and cabozantinib beating up on everolimus in their randomized phase threes, I think most people are moving that to very late lines, if not out altogether.
So let's talk about your patient, and I'm not sure how old the person is or the sex, but it's your third case, S status post BRMY, which I don't know what that is, but maybe a trial name.
I can describe. This was a young guy, actually. He was in his early 50s, real young, healthy guy. I think had had nephrectomy. I think he even had a recurrent thrombus and had a thrombectomy, which is unusual, but finally recurred with more distant disease. The BRMY study was Ipi plus Nevo in varying doses in different cohorts. And so he was on that study initially, actually had a response, not sort of listed here, but had actually hypopituitarism as a side effect of that toxicity. So came off, but actually maintained his response off therapy for quite some time, many months, if not over a year.
Hold on. Before you go on, you said a whole bunch of really interesting things there. I want to pick up one. I wasn't expecting that because it wasn't on the thing. So when he first went on this trial, this is first systemic therapy, was immunotherapy.
Yeah.
And where was his disease at that time, and was he symptomatic from it?
He wasn't symptomatic. He had adrenal lesions, and I think also then even had a further recurrent tumor thrombus in his IVC.
So he gets started on nivolumab and ipilimumab, and you were taking care of him at that time?
Yep, sure.
What happened to him clinically after you started treatment?
So he was fine initially, and then several weeks in developed really just profound fatigue, could almost barely make it into clinic. And so we suspected something endocrinologic, checked his serum cortisol and his TSH and such, and everything was suppressed. And so we suspected that he had hypopituitarism, actually did an MRI and showed pituitary enlargement, consistent, classic, if you've ever seen any of these anecdotes published.
I hear people talking about him all the time. I also hear people talking about a peculiar headache. Did he have that?
I don't remember him having headache. Yeah, I remember just extreme fatigue, just really being almost out of it.
And at that point, was he also responding?
He was. Yeah, so this is
he was having an objective response.
Correct. He was about 3 or 4 months in, had had maybe a scan or two at that point, was responding. I don't remember the, you know, whether it was what percentage reduction it was, but was definitely responding to therapy about this time.
So you put him on hormones and you got better?
Yeah. So, I mean, these people symptomatically improve pretty quickly, obviously, when you replace the hormones they're now not producing.
That's interesting. I don't know if you ever repeat the MRIs, but did the pituitary shrink down once you give him the hormones?
Yeah, I think we did, mostly for academic reasons, honestly. I don't know that you need to, because I think you do it up front to make sure there's nothing else there, like a tumor or something. Once they're better, I'm not sure there's much utility in repeating it. I think in this patient we did and saw that, but I don't do that routinely necessarily.
Any other tolerability issues or toxicities with him?
With this patient, no. This was his main toxicity, as I remember.
Any skin problems? Because I hear about these sort of low-grade skin problems. Anything there?
I don't think this patient had anything dermatologic with nivolumab monotherapy. I think that's probably one of the most common and earliest is this diffuse itchy rash, little flaky, not terrible, usually topical steroids, but that's common with nivo monotherapy for sure.
So he responds to treatment, and how long did the response last?
It lasted many months. So he came off at about 3 or 4 months, and then I think it was probably a good 12 to 18 months later. He was still responding, and then eventually sort of progressed, requiring additional treatment.
And he came off for what reason?
Came off therapy for the toxicity, for
really?
His hypopituitarism.
Hypopit? That seems kind of strange. I thought you continue it.
Well, his disease was really minimal at that point. So because he had this toxicity, albeit controlled, and we've done this with many patients, we didn't really feel that he needed further treatment. Obviously, we can replace him with hormones, but just not wanting to harm him. We didn't think he needed treatment. And then I think probably by the time he progressed And I don't remember how the study was written. I'm not sure we would have been able to treat him again because he was on a study, of course.
How are you, as long as we brought up that point, how are you approaching patients who have long-term responses in terms of stopping therapy? In this case, he had a problem, but if he had not had a problem or a patient like this, do you just keep it going?
Because these are largely in the context of trials now, each trial sort of mandates different things. Obviously, now we have nivolumab, and we really have kept going in the absence of problems. But a lot of people are starting to think about that question. So we're going to do a study of giving therapy intermittently based on response. I know others are going to do studies starting with one agent and maybe adding in another at progression. So people are starting to think about the duration of therapy or the need for ongoing therapy, but there's no prospective data to my knowledge.
So I want to come back and ask you about some of the data and your clinical experience with checkpoint inhibitors. Well, let's just keep going with this patient because I know you got a couple of TKIs, and I'm particularly interested to see what happened with him in terms of tolerability when he got to cabozantinib.
Yeah.
So what happened since he got the trial with the Nivo and Ipi?
So he went on axitinib second. As I mentioned, we do that often post-immunotherapy. He had a brief response to that drug. Went on another trial with a HIF inhibitor. Was on that for a relatively short period of time. And then started to
have... Could I just ask you, because I saw that on his write-up, a HIF inhibitor, and I've never heard of that. What is a HIF inhibitor? I mean, HIF is really, I guess, integral to the biology of RCC, but what are HIF inhibitors?
So this is, as you say, HIF is sort of a central transcription factor upstream of VEGF. And so while we have a bevy of VEGF inhibitors, we've not really had HIF inhibitors. And the idea is simple. Obviously, it's inhibiting upstream of VEGF to inhibit sort of that pathway more completely, perhaps. It was a phase one study, so it's really fairly early on in development. It's starting to go into some combo with other agents now, but the phase one data, and I believe some of the phase one's been presented, and I don't remember if it was ASCO or something, but in the last year, some preliminary data, he was part of that trial.
How'd he do tolerability-wise?
He did fine. He did fine with that. Yeah, there was no tolerability issues.
So in any event, then he went on, I see, to get radiation therapy of a couple of different types.
Yeah, right. Started to develop more bony mets. Sort of his progression was bony, unfortunately, which is not a great organ to have disease in. So got a little bit of spot welding, we'd say, to various sites.
And then I see he got everolimus. What happened with that?
Yeah, not much. And this is why we don't use the drug much. It was before Cabo was approved, I believe. And I guess we could have tried another TKI, but for whatever reason, tried him on everolimus and didn't really see much.
So then I see about 6 months ago, we got started on Cabo. What happened there?
Yeah, so he started at 60. He had a lot of fatigue, and so we reduced him to 40 fairly quickly. He was on that for, let's say, several weeks, still had persistent fatigue. So we actually ended up lowering him down to 20 milligrams a day, which he tolerated by that point. It was probably two or so months out, and unfortunately, we got scans, and he progressed and didn't get more therapy after that. So it was maybe the first patient I treated off protocol with cabozantinib, and admittedly, it was his fourth or fifth therapy after radiation, so he might have been set up not to tolerate, but I think brought out some of the tolerability issues.
You mentioned the fact that this man had a response to Nivo-Ipi. Can you talk about some of the key clinical research data sets we have right now with checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1, as well as combinations?
Well, the largest, of course, is with nivolumab, right? A single-agent PD-1 inhibitor showing a survival advantage against everolimus, as we alluded to. Response rate in the 20% range, similar to other TKIs in the refractory setting. No PFS advantage, interestingly, so perhaps a little bit more of a delayed effect, but again, very well tolerated. The trial that this patient was on with the combination with ipilimumab, a la a lot of the melanoma data, and there's a large phase three with that combination compared to sunitinib that's completed accrual, and I know will be the first sort of these large checkpoint-based phase threes to be reported, hopefully in the next year or so or whenever the timing is. So that's a really important trial that may change our initial standard approach to much of kidney cancer.
What's your experience and what's the clinical research data in terms of both anti-PD-1, say nivolumab alone, as well as with anti-CTLA-4, for example, ipilimumab? What we've heard from melanoma and other areas is a lot more toxicity, but qualitatively the same kinds of autoimmune problems. Is that the situation here?
Yeah, I think so. It's what I tell patients is that we're trying to inflame the tumor, but obviously you can inflame any organ, most commonly skin and gut and liver and whatnot. But so yeah, I think on paper, the toxicities by organ system are very similar, but certainly the percentages and the severity are much higher with the combo. And that'll be something that I think will need to be sorted out in each disease. I know it's being done in melanoma kidney cancer patients are going to be a little older, a little less healthy. And so whether or not it'll be able to be tolerated in kidney cancer to a large extent, I think remains to be seen.
What do we know about efficacy with the combination at this point and sort of indirectly comparing it to single agent?
We know from the cohort studies, the phase two studies of combination, the response rate was about 40%. And that's been reported in a couple abstracts, and there's a manuscript on its way to being submitted. And that, on the surface, is about double what the nivolumab monotherapy is. Progression-free survival is harder to interpret because that trial was a mix of frontline and refractory patients. So as you saw, our patient was frontline, which I think about half were, but about half were previously treated. So PFS can be a little hard to interpret in that setting. And I don't even know if survival was reported, honestly. It's only a phase two. So there's clearly activity, and I would say there's clearly more activity and more toxicity. So again, that balance will be important.
What are some of the new strategies incorporating checkpoint inhibitors that you're most excited about in addition to these combinations? What about targeted therapy and immunotherapy, for example?
Yeah, so that's the latest sort of combination wave. The immuno-immuno with ipi-nivo is first. There's a large randomized phase two and a separate phase three with atezolizumab, PD-L1 inhibitor, recently approved in bladder, and bevacizumab in combination, and also the atezolizumab as monotherapy and a sunitinib control arm. So that randomized phase two data, it's been accrued and probably will be reported next year as sort of a first signal of really comparative efficacy, although again, a randomized phase two. So we don't have any data from that. There's no public data from that, but a lot of patients treated on those two separate trials. And then most recently has been the checkpoint inhibitors plus TKIs. So perhaps most exciting was reported at ESMO by Mike Atkins is pembrolizumab plus axitinib. And so axitinib has also sort of emerged as the darling partner of these IO agents, I think in part based on its tolerability, seems to be very combinable, whereas some of the other TKIs, pazopanib and sunitinib notably, haven't quite been as tolerated. So the axitinib pembrolizumab, or axipembro as we often shorten it to, was reported at ESMO in a cohort of about 50 patients, 52, something like that, and reported a response rate of over 70%. Which is exceedingly notable with almost all patients showing tumor shrinkage. So early days, we don't have mature follow-up for PFS, et cetera, but at least at first blush, that level of activity we've not seen before.
What do we know about the efficacy of atezo alone in RCC?
I don't think we know anything. There was just a phase one with a handful of RCC patients, a 1B, I believe. And I can picture the spider plots, but I don't, you know, so there's definitely some activity, but I think it's relatively minimal, and it wasn't really developed as a single agent for RCC.
But the trial that you were talking about, so that's atezo and what was it?
Atezo and bevacizumab, that combination.
So really, that's if atezo is going to be used in renal, it would have to kind of be that way then.
Well, the registration trial is that combination compared to sunitinib. So if it's going to get approved, it's that combo that would likely get approved. In the randomized phase two, there was a atezo monotherapy arm. Again, we haven't seen data from that trial yet. We will have a little bit of data once that trial emerges for monotherapy.
Any thoughts about anti-angiogenics, including I've heard about Bev on and off being brought up as in some way having an immunologic activity, the theoretical reason why maybe there would be synergy between anti-angiogenic and a checkpoint inhibitor?
Yeah, I mean, there've been a lot of work over the years, some from our folks at Cleveland Clinic and many other places looking at the potential immunomodulatory role of VEGF agents. Sunitinib has a fair amount of data, Bev, as you say. And there does seem to be something there. You know, there seems to be some downregulation of immunosuppressive cells like regulatory T cells and myeloid-derived suppressor cells, some promotion of cytotoxic T cell cytokine production. And so that's mostly peripheral blood data. It's not necessarily tumor biopsies. So, you know, there's some data to support. At the end of the day, a lot of these combinations are purely empiric clinical combinations. You have active drug A and active drug B, and they're different mechanisms, and we put them together. And so far, it seems that there's activity to those combos.
So we've talked a little bit about the Nivo data, Nivo combination, atezo data. What about Pembro?
So Pembro has combination data with axitinib that I mentioned, and that's moved on to a phase three that's just starting. Again, compared with sunitinib, these are all really compared to sunitinib as the control.
What about Pembro alone as second-line therapy?
So there is no data of Pembro as second-line therapy. There's a separate trial from the phase three that's looking at Pembro as monotherapy in frontline and also in non-clear cell. So kind of a separate question related to obviously the phase three development strategy, but separate. So we don't really have a lot of pembro mono data in kidney cancer. In fact, I'm not sure I can think of any offhand. I don't know if they're in phase one data or things like that, but no phase two and beyond data yet.
What about durvalumab and tremelimumab?
So durvalumab and tremi, they've not been given to kidney cancer patients, to my knowledge. Certainly, again, maybe a handful in the phase one. We're actually going to be doing a neoadjuvant trial with those drugs, mostly to look at tissue and blood-based endpoints and immunologic endpoints. So we'll get some data there. But again, that's in a locally advanced setting, not a metastatic setting. So I don't know that there's a plan to develop them for metastatic disease. I think they're pursuing other indications.
A couple issues about checkpoint inhibitors I'm kind of curious about. Again, you can imagine we're talking about checkpoint inhibitors, seems like almost every different kind of cancer now. A couple of issues that kind of go through, I'm just curious if you have any experience with. One is, I don't know how often this happens, but the patient with prior autoimmune disease, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, do you ever encounter it? Any thoughts about how to manage that situation?
Yeah, I mean, of course, they've been excluded from the trials. You know, I've not yet been brave enough to treat such a patient in clinical practice with Nevo. I came across, there's a small series of melanoma patients who have some type of autoimmune disease, and it was 12 or 15 patients, and showing that it can be done, although they, in some, but not all patients, there were serious toxicity. And I don't remember all the data offhand, but I think we're, you know, as these drugs get more ubiquitous and get approved in more diseases, there's going to have to be some guidance. And maybe not all autoimmune diseases are the same, right? I mean, maybe Crohn's is not okay, but MS is okay or something. I have no idea, but I'm, you know, it may not be one size fits all or doesn't fit all in that setting.
What have you observed in terms of your own clinical experience using nivolumab as a single agent in RCC?
As I mentioned previously, the most striking thing is tolerance. You know, it's a really well-tolerated drug. And so if nothing else, I feel like I'm helping the patient by giving them a period of feeling good. You know, I think from a response and PFS perspective, you know, our data mirrors the published registration data. I think there is one unique feature of that drug we haven't touched on is, you know, I think there is a chance for very long-term response with that drug, maybe more so than the TKIs. I don't know what percentage that is. Will it be 10% or 30%? I don't know. I think it'll be somewhere in that range. But obviously, that has some appeal as well, a well-tolerated drug with very long-term disease control, albeit in a subset.
What about its use in upfront therapy? Older patient, a patient who you're really concerned about even giving a TKI?
Yeah, I mean, there's just no data. So, you know, I haven't done it. The only data I'm aware of, there was about 100 patient study that was a biomarker study, and a small fraction of those, somewhere between 10 and 20, had not had prior treatment. So, of course, that's, you know, a collection of anecdotes. It's not real data. But I think what we'll start to see now as the registration trial is finishing, et cetera, is more investigator-initiated studies that are going to look at that question. Nevo alone versus Nevo plus Ipi, or adding Ipi at progression, et cetera. So right now we just have no data. We don't know that, even if well-tolerated, that it's efficacious, frankly. And then there are some other drugs. We'll be doing a randomized phase two of sunitinib and avelumab, PD-L1 inhibitor. Again, just to start to look at that question of almost TKI versus checkpoint in the frontline setting.
What about non-clear cell renal cell cancer, particularly in terms of response to systemic therapy, TKIs, mTOR inhibitors, and particularly checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, so we know very little. I mean, there have been, you know, a handful of non-clear cell patients on some of the early trials. The phase threes have really excluded those patients for no biologic reason, by the way, but just to make it a more homogeneous population, far as I'm concerned. But we, as I mentioned, there will be a pembrolizumab trial in non-clear cell. I think there's some others going on as well. We're not participating in the others, but I think I've seen mention of them or an ASCO trials in progress or something like that. So we don't really know. In practice, I've treated probably a handful of non-clear cell. So again, it's just my collection of anecdotes. I don't know that their response is any better or worse than the clear cell. They need options too. And so I have a feeling that at the end of the day, we'll be using these drugs in non-clear cell and activity to be defined, so to speak.
Somebody sent me this question. I never really thought about it, but do you see microsatellite instability in renal cell? You know, this has been obviously in colon cancer and gastric cancer. What about in renal cell?
Not to my knowledge. I've never seen any data on that, so not that I'm aware of.
I never heard of it either.
Yeah.
We had a case sent in, a 62-year-old man, metastatic clear cell renal cell cancer with hard-to-control hypertension. How would that affect the way you, say, approach first-line therapy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, VEGF agents are frontline standard, and they obviously can cause hypertension. So we see these patients. We're blessed with a good cardiology group, so we'll be exceedingly aggressive in managing their blood pressure, sometimes up to 3 and 4 medicines a day. Those kind of patients might need extra medicine while they're on drugs, say if it's a sunitinib on-off schedule, hydralazine or clonidine or something that they can sort of pop, if you will, as needed throughout their dosing and then maybe back off during the off period. That's a fairly rare patient. Almost all patients have a little hypertension or on a little Norvasc or something, but having really refractory 3 and 4 drug hypertension is unusual. But obviously it happens, as this case highlights. You know, when we've come across it, it's hard because, again, there's not a lot of other drugs to choose from at present. If Ipi-Nivo gets approved, then that would be an option, right? That would be a non-VEGF option. Using mTOR as frontline is really not standard, although there are obviously data for temsirolimus, so that may even be a patient you would choose that in, even if they're not poor risk. So that's very tricky. Not standard, very tricky.